Welcome to the Alcohol Addiction Podcast. My name is Lee Davey. I am not an alcoholic. I refuse to be anonymous. I am someone that doesn't drink alcohol. I spend every waking moment helping other people do the same. Like right now, in this episode of the podcast, Obi-Wan Kenobi, we're going to do things a little bit different today. We're going to have a live podcast with members of Strive joining from various different places around the world. I can see that Stella's there, fresh back from her travels in New Zealand. Hi, Stella. She's back in the UK. And we got Holly online, all the way from Hawaii. How's it going, Holly? So people might join in as I continue talking, or it might just be to these two lovely ladies. Who knows, right? But you won't be able to hear them until I unmute them at the end to ask some questions. And yeah, that's what it's all about. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk a little about a post that Kim made. Kim is one of our newest drivers, and Kim joined the taster. So she came straight into the taster after listening to us on the podcast, and she did the taster and had a wonderful experience, and now she's currently taking the intensive. Now, before I get to the post, which she called Obi-Wan Kenobi, I want to just relay back to you her feedback on the taster, because I think it's super important. Because, you know, when you listen to this podcast, you really have no idea what it's like on Strive. You have no idea what it's like to take the taster. You have no idea what it's like to take the intensive. I mean, Kim just had a peek at the intensive and she was like, oh my God, like, this is what people do here. You know, it's the only way you're going to get to know these things is by hearing these stories. So this is what Kim had to say, right? Taking a TTAA taster has been one of the most transformational things I've ever done. I've struggled for many years with daily drinking, and it has systematically made me miserable, ashamed, and unhealthy. We can all relate to that, right? Over the years, it has also eroded the relationships I have with my husband and my children. In the taster, I got to really delve into my relationship with alcohol and why I drink. I got to see clearly the structural belief systems around alcohol, which society has been led to believe from birth, and to question those beliefs in depth. What I learned by going through the taster, doing the daily assignments, and interacting with fellow strivers was that the lens I was using to look at alcohol was completely distorted, and that there was a different lens available, one that told the complete truth without the con. Now I have completed the taster. I can definitely see more clearly, and I'm looking forward to signing up to the intensive to continue this journey. I have found structure, support, and acceptance in his virtual Strive community. This has been crucial for me to move forward in my journey to become someone who doesn't drink alcohol. In my years of searching for support to help me with my drinking issues, I have never found anything like this before. This works. Thank you, Lee, Craig, and all of the Strivers who have supported me this last month. You have a permanent place in my heart. Love, Kim. And just a couple of things on that. I mean, one, she says, I have found structure, support, and acceptance in this virtual Strive community. It's not just a virtual Strive community anymore. Lisa has just landed in, I'm going to screw this up, Kauai, in Hawaii, and she's going to hook up with Holly soon. And Stella has just come back from her trip to New Zealand, where she met up with Trooper Alcohol Ambassador Nikki, and she's also been to Colorado, where she met up with Striver Lisa. So we're all trying to get more personal and to really kind of deepen these friendships that we develop through Strive. Really super important. The other thing is just to say is she's thanking Craig there, because Craig is one of our Truth About Alcohol ambassadors. And if you ever take the taster, one of our ambassador team will guide you through the experience. And Craig did that with Kim, and he'll now stick with Kim to go through the intensive. We really look forward to seeing Kim's progress there. Now onto a post Obi-Wan Kenobi, right? And I'll just read it out to you, and I'll stop in between reading it out, and I'll put my own spin on it or share my thoughts. And at the end of the post, then I'll open it up to Stella and to Holly to see if they've got any questions on what I've spoke about and to share what's going on in their lives, right, as people who don't drink alcohol. So here's her post. Day 7 here, says Kim, and I had a huge day which involved 4 hours of driving. I drove through town on my way home, and a feeling washed over me as I drove past the pub that I could get a bottle of wine, as it would be so pleasurable to sit down with a nice cold glass of wine when I got home. My resistance, in brackets, I realize that now, said things like, nobody will know, it's okay to have a setback, the pleasure will be worth the pain, yada, 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 right? So if you're jogging down the street right now and you didn't quite hear all that, What basically Kim is saying is she's on day 7 of the taster. She hasn't had a drink for 7 days, but she's driving for four hours. She's had a massive kind of day, and she's driving past a pub where she usually stops and goes in to have a glass of wine, right? But she's not in that mindset right now because she's trying to resist against it. But suddenly, this voice pops up in her head, which we call the resistance, and it starts saying things like, well, nobody will know if you have a drink, right? And it's much, much better to drink than to not drink and all this kind of nonsense, okay? Now, what I want to say, just to dissect her post at that point, is that I believe that naming the voice that encourages you to drink alcohol when you don't want to is a really positive thing, okay? Now, I've always referred to this voice as the resistance ever since reading Stephen Pressfield's The War of Art, okay? And if you've never read Stephen Pressfield's work, please read it. The War of Art, Turning Pro, and Doing the Work in particular are amazing, amazing pieces of literature around the resistance. And the reason I use the term resistance is the way Stephen Pressfield coined it, is that the truth about alcohol, we are much more about alcohol. Yeah, we help people to stop drinking, but what we really are aiming for is to be people that don't drink alcohol. And that means something very specific to us strivers, right? It's becoming the better versions of ourselves. And resistance doesn't just pop up, these voices don't just pop up in our head when it comes to like whether or not I'm going to drink alcohol or not. It pops up in our head when we decide whether we're going to exercise or not, whether we're going to watch the third episode of the OA or not, whether we're going to have our fifth drink of coffee in the morning, whether or not we're going to have sex with our husband or not have sex with him, on and on and on and on and on, right? So for me, the resistance has more of a universal appeal to it. However, there are other people who use names to define this voice, particularly for alcohol. If any of you follow Belle from Tired of Thinking About Drinking, she calls her little voice Wolfie. And Stella, who if you're watching the YouTube, you can see her lying in bed right now. Stella calls hers Chucky, all right, from the old kind of killer Chucky doll. Remember that, right? So we all have our little names. But I think it's really important because in naming it, and I say it in inverted commas, this voice, we can place the thoughts and feelings beneath a rational lens, which we really need because if we don't name it and it just is what it is, then what it is a fireball of emotion that is going to scorch you from the inside out. But if we apply some rational and logical focus on it, we can actually start to unpick some of the wisdom that comes from this voice, from all the nonsense. And it's like 80% nonsense, 20% wisdom, right? I also think if you think about it, it's so much easier to engage in conversation with someone when we know somebody's name for some reason, right? Well, it's like one of the first things you say to people, hey, what's your name, right? You know, so for me, naming something is really, really powerful. Now, in terms of creating this conversation with resistance, right? Now we've named it, we can have a conversation with it because we know its name, we know it exists, it's more relevant to us. It's almost like we've dragged it from a subconscious into the conscious thought, right? It's always better to have this conversation with it in writing. So you either get a notepad like this and a pen, okay, and then you write down the conversation that you're having with your resistance, or you type it out on your keyboard. Either way, the way I look at this, if you think about football or sport, all right, let's say you get two teams of equal skill level, and one's playing home and one's playing away. Well, scientific research will show you that a team that's playing home will have an advantage over the team that's playing away. Okay. Now, if we start to write out what we're doing is we are taking home court advantage. We're saying to resistance, hey, if you want to play this game, come over to my fucking backyard and play it, right? Because we're writing this shit down. That is our home turf. That is our arena. If you don't do that, then what is going to happen is you're going to continue to have a conversation in your mind. And your mind is the resistance playground. It's where the resistance hangs out and where he is more familiar. So really important to write shit out, right? Now, what happens when you start to write things out and you start to have this conversation and lay it out on a piece of paper, this is the beginning of cognitive dissonance, all right? And I'm just going to do a quote from the American psychologist Leon Festinger. I don't know if that's how you pronounce his name, but he says, when dissonance is present, in addition to trying to reduce it, the person will actively avoid situations and information which would likely increase it, okay? Let's say that again. When dissonance is present, in addition to trying to reduce that dissonance, the person will actively avoid situations and information which will increase the dissonance. Now, I'm just going to unmute the two ladies here, and I'm going to put them on the spot. Okay. So, ladies, I'm going to ask you a question, right? We've got this cognitive dissonance in our mind when it comes to alcohol. Shall I drink? Shall I not drink? Shall I drink? Shall I not drink? How do people who drink alcohol quieten that dissonance? Who wants to take a shot at it? Go on, Holly.
They justify it.
And what do they do?
They try to tell you that, and they try to tell you that it's not, you know, it's moderate. Why can't you just have one, or, you know, all these different things, or I never had a problem with it, or it's, or they try to tell you that red wine is good for your health and, you know, it's an antioxidant, blah, blah, blah.
Okay. So what you're talking about there is you're actually agreeing with resistance, right? Mm-hmm. So you start agreeing with it. So if you're someone who doesn't drink, if you're someone who drinks alcohol and the cognitive dissonance presents itself, what Holly is saying there is you actually start agreeing and aligning yourself with, okay, the resistance. And then what you do, I'm just going to mute you all again, girls. What you then actually do is you drink. So the way you quiet the cognitive dissonance when you're somebody that drinks alcohol is you drink alcohol. Because if you drink alcohol, now that voice goes away because now you're drinking and you're okay. That's what you want to do until the next time, okay, the resistance comes up in your mind. You're more aware of it because you're listening to this podcast or you're doing the taster or you're on a member of Strive or you've read Alan Carr's book or something. And then you go through the same process again. Okay. And that goes in line with what Leon Festinger is saying. When dissonance is present, in addition to trying to reduce it, the person will actively avoid situations and information which would likely increase the dissonance. So the conversely, they want to decrease the dissonance. So by drinking, it quietens it. Because if you remember, when we were drinkers, before we realized we had an issue, there was no dissonance. We just drank alcohol. Maybe we'd have a little bit of dissonance when we woke up on a Saturday morning, puking into a bucket, and we'd say things like, oh, I'm never going to fucking drink again. But that's not in the same ballpark. You know, it's a little bit like when people talk about New Year's resolutions when it comes to habit change, not in the same ballpark. It's like Cracker Jack. It's like little trinkets. That's nothing. It's nonsense. Okay. So what happens to people who drink alcohol to quieten cognitive dissonance? They drink more alcohol, right? Now, what do people do that don't drink alcohol? What do they do to quieten the resistance, right? They don't drink alcohol. Now, think about this. A lot of people think when cognitive dissonance pops up in the mind that the way to solve it is to drink alcohol. Oh my God, I can't fucking handle this. This is so fucking crazy. My fucking brain's going to explode in a minute. I just whistle noises. Shut up. Oh, fantastic. Well, at Strive and the Truth About Alcohol, we do it a different way. Oh my God, I whistle fucking noises. Shut up. My fucking eyes do my head and my head's going to explode in a minute. Okay. Calm breath. Calm down. What did I learn off Strive? Okay. I just got to give myself a break. I'm going to put a Sam Harris meditation on. I'm just going to go outside into nature. And I'm just going to sit down. I'm going to listen to this for 10 minutes. Then I'm going to go on to Strive. I'm going to go on to Triggers. I'm going to answer these 13 fucking stupid questions. I'm going to answer them. And I'm going to ring somebody. Like, who's my buddy? Holly. I'm going to ring up Holly. And I'm going to tell her that I'm in trouble. And Lee says, what have I got to do? I got to sit and feel this thing. I've got to experience it. What's he on about? All right, let's give it a go. What is it? I've got a bit of a tightness in my stomach. It's not exactly like there's a fucking knife going through it, is there? And then what does he say? I gotta watch Netflix? What, I gotta watch an episode of Game of Thrones? 1 hour later, whoa, let's put another episode on. Yeah, you know what I'm getting at, folks, right? I'm having a bit of fun and poking a bit of fun there, but we don't drink alcohol. And if we don't drink alcohol long enough and we continue to not drink alcohol long enough, then guess what happens? There is no Chucky, there is no Wolfie, and the resistance that raises itself in your head, which will always be there, will not be pestering you about alcohol. He would have moved on about your no-fi gap or whatever is fucking in the news today, right? He will not be talking to you about alcohol. So that is really important. When it comes to cognitive dissonance, we need to create cognitive dissonance, because the reason very often that we're drinking alcohol is that we don't have any cognitive dissonance anymore. We hacked the head off that beast when we was in our teenage years, right? Now we become so addicted to alcohol with 10 to 20, 30 decades, not just of drinking the stuff, because look, let's be honest, right? You know, how many people listen to this podcast or who have joined Strive or in the Taste or in the Intensive, right? How many of them have had really bad withdrawal symptoms from alcohol, right? I haven't had many people come to Strive that have had really bad withdrawal symptoms from alcohol. Over like 4 or 5 days, it's done, right? So it doesn't matter that we drunk this stuff for 30, 40 years physically. What is happening is mentally, it's all the bullshit that we've kind of like consumed from social media, from TV, from movies, from adverts, from sitting on the back of an aeroplane and seeing a gin advert in front of you and your two-year-old kid, right? To like your entire social structure. That stuff that you've had for like decades and decades and decades, if you didn't have a mechanism whereby you could silence a cognitive dissonance, you'd end up in an asylum. And you've done a really good job at that. But what I'm here to tell you is, right, you can quieten that same noise, you can quieten that cognitive dissonance by not drinking. All right. And we, and Holly's evidence of that. Stelly's, Stelly? Who's Stelly? Stella's evidence of that. I'm evidence of that, right? You can do it. All right. So I'm going to go back to the post that Kim wrote. Then it was like Obi-Wan Kenobi whispered in my ear, she said. So think about it. She's driving past the pub. The resistance has started to pike up and say to her, go into the pub and have a drink, et cetera, et cetera. So she says, Obi-Wan Kenobi pops up into her ear and says, remember your training, all right? And I thought, there's no bloody way I'm logging on to Strive in the morning and telling everybody that I drank. There's no bloody way I'm going to pretend to you all that I didn't. And I thought about how I would feel in the morning having broken my vow. Okay. I remembered Lee saying before I took the taster vow to not drink for the duration of the taster that I had to use, and she puts this in capital letters, every tool I have to avoid having a drink before I drank. I didn't have to use them all, as Obi-Wan Kenobi stepped in with his sage advice and I was relieved. So the craving is over. And I think I'll post this one in triggers too. It was quite a strong one. I got through it, which I'm impressed with, because it can be a slippery little sucker. Like the way she said sucker there, I would have used the word fucker, which rhymes like sucker, by the way. 2 days ago, I found a fabulous restaurant in Silk Lake called, oh, this is me. God, I'm going too far here. All right, so that's Kim's post, okay? Now, in relating to Kim's post, 2 days ago, I found a fabulous restaurant in Silver Lake, right, in LA, called Bowery Bungalow. If you're ever in Silver Lake and you like Middle Eastern food, go to Bowery Bungalow, right? Now, at the time I went in there, I'd been on a ketogenarian diet, whatever you want to call it, keto diet, whatever, okay, to try to reduce my bloating in my belly. I have a bloating issue, right? So I've been eating keto. And during the ride there, I was reading an article by the medical medium. Has anyone heard of the medical medium? The guy who's telling you to eat, he was like screwing the whole world of celery stocks, right? So he's the guy who's telling everyone to eat celery and you can't buy celery anymore because of medical medium. Well done, medical medium. Anyway, so I read in an article on bloating by the medical medium because I've got this keto thing and I've been trying to eat keto, but all of a sudden, I give you an example, right? A couple of days ago, I'm in a museum. It's 4:30 in the afternoon. I'm absolutely starving. I'm just looking at some art and all of a sudden my belly just went whoop. Honestly, it looked like I was pregnant. I hadn't eaten anything, nothing. I was hungry, but there was something going on in my stomach that was causing this. All right, this big fat belly. Okay, so I was reading about it with a medical medium, and the medical medium started to say that, you know, if all this keto nonsense about eating all these fats, even healthy fats like avocado, coconut oil, etc., etc., it's going to fuck up your liver, right? And that is going to lead to bloating because your liver is going to be overworked, right? Okay, now I'm not here to debate whether Dr. Will Cole, for example, who's going to be a guest on the podcast soon. Who wrote the ketogenarian diet or the ketotarian diet and medical medium, who's right or wrong. I think it's all different for us, right? But this what I'm going to say next is really important, okay? Reading the medical medium saying, hey, you know, you don't have to just eat fruit and vegetables, because if you do, you can have a problem with your liver. Whoa, didn't resistance rear up in my head, right? So all of a sudden it was like, fuck it, I'm going to go to a Middle Eastern restaurant and I'm going to eat couscous, right? Not exactly. Like, you know, it's not like I'm like whacking some heroin in my veins or fucking hardballing coke. This is how mad I get. Like when I go on a fucking mental meltdown, I eat couscous. All right. So I go there and the guy comes along, the waiter guy, who looked a little bit like Zac Efron. And I, after he'd left that, so I turned around and said to Liza, I've got a man crush on this guy. Like I kept calling him over to order shit I didn't even need just because I wanted to look into his eyes, right? Anyway, so I fall in love with Zac Efron, and he asked me what I want, and I said, I'll have that that couscous thing. You know, and I said it like, I'm fucking hard, I'm gonna eat couscous, right? So he gets this couscous and I eat it. I just think, fuck it, I'm going to eat this couscous, right? And then, and most of you will know that I don't eat sugar. I don't like eating sugar. Like, you know, it's something that I don't like doing. I've worked really hard to do it, right? But then, like, after like the couscous rush, like, I'm just like fucking crazy now. So I'm like, I call Zach over again. And after like 10 minutes of looking into his eyes, I say, Zach, I'll have some rice pudding. So he orders some rice pudding, right? Now, why did I eat the couscous and why did I eat the rice pudding? Well, I ate the couscous because I really, really, really wanted to eat it, right? I ate the rice pudding because I really, really, really wanted to eat it, okay? Now, this is important, tying into the Obi-Wan Kenobi post. The reason we succumb to our triggers so easy and so quickly, all right, is because, and there's no other way of dressing this up, we fucking love drinking alcohol. All right, we love it. We love it so much that when our triggers come and our cognitive dissonance comes up and resistance pipes up and says, hey, I think you should drink that alcohol, you're like, whoa, did he just say I could drink alcohol? Fucking boom, boom. Right? The thought of actually going through these 13 questions, it's no wonder nobody wants to do it. Do you know why? Because by the time you've got to the end of the 13 questions, by the time you've walked into nature and you've got your little, your shack with Ralph Waldo Emerson or whoever was living in there, and then you know, you read War and Peace and you listen to your meditation up by Sam Harris, do some stretching, you go for a run, you watch an episode of Game of, by the time you've all done that, you're not going to want to drink, but you want to drink, right? You really want to drink. So this is why all of a sudden when you have a trigger moment that we relapse so quickly, because we want to drink and we need to accept and understand that we want to drink. What is actually going on here is the pros of drinking in that moment are far outweighing the pros of abstaining, all right? And the way that we get to this point where we no longer want to give into this thing is when the pros of abstaining are far greater than the pros of drinking. It's not that easy, okay? It's a lot more complicated than that. And when you're at Strive and you're doing all your Strive work and you're doing your taste of work and you're talking to people and you're watching our videos and going through the assignments, there's a lot of other stuff that comes into that. But on a very, very basic level, if you want to just do one thing today to move you forward towards being someone that doesn't drink alcohol, then get a little bit of paper out, slice it down the middle. Say, what are the pros of me drinking and what are the pros of me abstaining? All right. And what you'll find is your pros of drinking will far outweigh the pros of you abstaining. And until you turn that around, you're not going to be ready to change, right? You're not going to be ready to take the taster. You won't want to take it, all right? Or you'll take it and you'll just waste your money. Don't give me any money until you're ready to do it, because it'll just be a waste of money, okay? So we can't rely on willpower alone. So if you're reading that, what Kim isn't relying on willpower alone here. It seems like she is as she's driving past a pub, but she's not really. And there are three things here that really make me kind of wake up a little bit and go, oh, yeah. She's not on willpower alone here. Number one, the vow. All right. So how many of you here listening to this are married? All right. So how many of you are listening to this are married? You spent fucking tens of millions of pounds that you don't have, probably put it on a credit card or, you know, whatever, you got some rich mum to pay for it or whatever. And then you go down the aisle and you do your knees, and even though, like me, like people who don't believe in God, like, you know, sing prayers and all that kind of stuff. And all of a sudden you make this vow and you look into your wife's eyes and you recite those words, and I don't know, in sickness and in health and all that kind of stuff. And then after you leave, that's it. You are this person's property for life, right? There's no way, nothing is going to change this. You're never, ever going to have sex with another human being. You will not, because you took a vow that you're going to be with this person. And a vow in marriage means monogamy in most of our culture, particularly people listening to this. So if you go to Silver Lake and you walk into a Middle Eastern restaurant and Zac Efron starts flashing his eyebrows at you, oh, I might have wanted to take him into the, you know, into the toilet and give him a good scene too, but I couldn't do it because I had taken a vow, you know, that I would be with this woman for the rest of my life. So, you know, it sucks sometimes, doesn't it? Vows suck. You know, you want to have sex with that person. You want to cuddle with that person. You want to just run away to the moon and just get rid of her because she's getting on your nerves or he's getting on your nerves. But you don't, because you took a vow. And yeah, divorce rates are really, really high. But as someone who's gone through a divorce, and lots of people listening to this will go to a divorce, how fucking difficult is it to rip yourself apart from that person once you've taken that vow? It is so, so difficult, right? So, so difficult, okay? So we know and understand the power of the vow. Now, if you can transfer that power of the vow, the marriage vow, to your vow to not drink alcohol, now we're talking some serious shit. right? Because now a vowel means something. Like it's super, it's almost like on a consciousness level. It's like it's a visceral thing. It's not like, you can't even explain it. But if you were married, the likelihood that you're now going to jump in bed with somebody else, it happens. Don't get me wrong, it happens. And it normally happens when you've had a drink of alcohol. But if you are not drinking alcohol, the likelihood of that happening is really, really, it's really minute, because you have taken a vow and that vow aligns with some pretty serious core values, one of them being integrity, okay? So when we're in the taster, when we turn around and say we're taking a vow, we're putting our integrity out there, right? We're putting our integrity out there. Now, this is super important. When you take the vow to not drink for 27 days and you drink during that 27 days, but you've really, really tried hard not to drink, or you tried everything in your power not to drink, then that gets a pass for me, right? That gets a pass because you are really trying to actually overcome one of the most powerful addictions in the world. But but you're trying, and this is what I'm going to say second and third is what Kim talks about. You have created a toolkit and you've used that toolkit. All right. So if you create a toolkit whilst you're doing the taster, or while you're at Strive, or while you're on the intensive, talking and sharing and asking all the experienced people on there that have done these things, if you do that, okay, and you create that toolkit, then you must fucking use that toolkit. All right. Now, not using that toolkit is the quick, fastest way for you to drink alcohol. So if you love alcohol and you have a trigger and you want to drink, don't use your toolkit. All right. But the reason Kim got through it, it's because as she was driving past that pub, she used her toolkit. Obi-Wan Kenobi popped up. That's no piece of luck, random luck that Obi-Wan turned up. She created Obi-Wan Kenobi as a mechanism to defeat the resistance. She could almost in her mind say that resistance is Darth Vader and she has created Obi-Wan Kenobi. All right, Darth Vader kills Obi-Wan Kenobi. Maybe I shouldn't have used that one as a good example. But ultimately, Darth Vader dies, doesn't he, because of Obi-Wan Kenobi's legacy and all that kind of stuff. But you see what I mean? She's created something. She's created the antithesis to the resistance, right? This is different voice, this rational, logical voice, which is now going to compete against the emotional voice of Darth Vader, okay? And then she's thinking, isn't she, that I took a vow. So now she's got her integrity is on the line, all right? So as she's driving along, she's thinking about accountability, okay? Now a guilt comes in a little bit, all right? Not shame, but guilt, all right? So guilt is coming in. I feel guilty if I post and tell all these wonderful people that they've helped me so much that I've like, screwed up and had a bit of a drink, right? She doesn't want to do that. So what she's done is she's used that guilt in a very positive way. And you know, nowhere in Kim's post do you hear her saying, I didn't like the fact that I was accountable. It made me feel bad. I didn't like accountability. I didn't like the fear of not being able to post. I've not seen that in any of Kim's posts. All Kim's posts have been, wow, it was scary as fuck to be vulnerable, but I'm so fucking glad I did it. I felt so much better afterwards. I absolutely loved offloading. I love what I'm doing, sharing with people. You know, I think that is super important. Now, it's not easy to do what Kim did. All right. Now, we at The Truth About Alcohol, we use the color code personality science. All of us go through like a little test to see what kind of personality we are. And Kim is a red personality type, right? Which is power. Okay. Without going into too in depth, Kim's got some serious grit and determination behind her personality-wise. So she's not going to give up easily. But the other colors, the yellows, the blues, and the whites, they also have very, very strong traits that can enable them to navigate their way through this and to not succumb so easily. So a white, for example, a white color, a white is the opposite of power. It's like peace and hey, dude, like I'm a pacifist. And like, you know, I don't want any trouble. But they are still stubborn as fuck. Like, they're highly, fiercely independent, okay? And these traits can be used when it comes to things like the vow, et cetera, et cetera. And at Truth About Alcohol, we're learning more and more about this color code science, all right? And we can use it, our ambassadors can use it the more we learn about it. We can use it in a way that we communicate with you to draw out the best parts of your personality types so you can use these best parts of your personality traits to stick with your vow, to create toolkits and all that kind of stuff. And the more you do this, the easier it gets, okay? This is really important. So she's on day 7 there, day 8, day 9, day 10, day 11, day 12. The further you get away from having a drink, the fewer triggers you get and the more capable you are of sitting with that feeling and letting it pass. Okay. So getting timing is really important. Okay. So we don't want to use willpower to do it. Like using willpower to deal with this is a little bit like going to fight like the guy around the corner with a compass in your hand and he's got a cricket bat, or, you know, it's like, I did that actually when I was 10. I had a compass and the kid had a cricket bat. That's why I use that as an example. Didn't end well. So that's the thing, right? You want to go there with some real power behind you, okay? So for me, willpower is not the thing. Being a strive, taking your vow, creating a toolkit and using that toolkit is super important. Sitting with the feelings, which Kim did as she was driving, okay? It's not as bad as resistance makes out. I'm telling you, I've had this feedback across the board. Across the board, unless you are somebody who sits on the very, very end of this alcoholic spectrum, and like if you stop drinking alcohol, you would die. Like if you're on that end of the spectrum, other than those type of people who need really serious medical help, everybody else that comes to Strive, who are the people who are drinking one or two bottles of wine a night or whatever, right? Those people sitting with the feelings and experiencing the craving and it going is nowhere near as bad as the resistance makes out, right? We want to buy into it. Like we want to buy into this is really difficult, because if this isn't really difficult, then why didn't I do this so long ago? Okay. It's not as bad as you think. Also what Kim does really well, she feels liberated after she doesn't have a drink. She's like a fucking Amazonian. She's like standing in that arena with her sword up in the air going, yeah, I fucking nailed this thing. It's sitting on the floor. She's spitting on it, kicking it in the balls, all kinds of stuff, right? She's feeling a sense of joy and she's feeling a sense of pride. Now, if you can, once you have a mini accomplishment like she did, you have to really, really soup up this joy and soup up this pride, okay? It's really important, because the way that our brain works in creating declarative and non-declarative memories, which we learn a little bit about in a taste, but more in intensive, it's all about connecting emotion with thought, right? So we need to be, right now, we have joy and we have pride associated with drinking alcohol, don't we? We don't want that. We want to associate misery and failure with drinking alcohol and joy and pride of not drinking alcohol, right? That is what we want to do. So celebrate the victory. Really super important. What else have I written here? We have to also acknowledge that most people are not like what Kim did here. On day 7, Kim got through this. On day 12, Kim didn't get through it. She did succumb to a trigger. She did use not all of her tools in her toolkit, some of them, but she had a drink, right? But then, get this, day 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, and counting, she has beaten this beast every single time. Now, is that a failure that we've had one drink in 27, 30 days? Or is that a fucking heroic, amazing run? I think that's brilliant. I think it's amazing, right? And that is the way Kim has been looking at this thing. Now, what Kim did on day 12, when she did have a drink, is super important, okay? She mined that incident for all the gold she could get. I tell you, I believe Kim's progress has been accelerated because she drank on day 12. Now, I'm not saying that you should go and drink. And please, right now, resistance is in your head saying, Lee said I could have a drink because it's really good that I can experiment. No, it's not. It's not good, all right? Try not to drink. But if you do drink, the worst thing you can do if you drink is give in to resistance, let shame and guilt take it over and run away. What Kim did is she said to herself, I got to fight this. And she went straight on the triggers and she posted the 13 question. The next day, she did the same. Next day, she did the same, okay? Think about the courage that it takes. That everybody knows you're on a mission to stop drinking. You told everybody you're not going to drink. You told everybody you've taken a vow, and then you drink. And now you've got to post and tell everybody. Imagine how fucking scary that is, how fearful that is, right? But here's the thing, a strive, when you do that, everybody comes out of the woodwork. The strivers who very, very rarely post, they come out and they support you when you're posting triggers. They come out and support you when you introduce yourself for the first time, because they know and they remember what it felt like. And you get all that support. And all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, I was worrying that I was riddled with shame and I was worried that I'd let everybody down. And everyone's like, don't worry about it, man. We've all done the same thing. It kind of happens. But now the most important thing is pull up your britches, get that sword up again. What can you learn from this experience? What was it about alcohol that fooled you into believing it had value? Let's work on that, right? Get back into the arena. That is super, super important. You need to find the courage, okay, to post in the triggers category. And because courage, if you read anything about Brené Brown, is really intertwined with vulnerability, okay? And working at Strive, for me anyway, the best way that you can develop courage by being vulnerable is by posting on Strive every day how you feel, okay? My wife pisses me off because of X, Y, Z. What's one for me right now? Just like I'll be vulnerable with you, right? I have a two-year-old kid, Zia. She slapped me in the face the other day. You know, it's like my whole world had like fallen apart. She screams. She has tantrums. She acts like what I would call a little princess. And my brain keeps going back to Jude thinking, why? Jude wasn't like that. Why is this kid turn into a monster? What am I doing wrong as a dad? What am I going to do on a plane when everyone's going to look at me going, well, that guy can't control his kid, right? You know? So last night, I was very vulnerable. I spoke to my wife about it and said, hey, look, you know, I'm really, really struggling here and I need your help and support. But more than that, I just want to tell you how I feel. You know, I want to tell you how I feel. I think my kid's a monster and I want to tell you I think that. Now, that is being vulnerable to say that you think your kid's a monster. Because obviously she's not a fucking monster, right? And then people come out and go, oh, well, yeah, I had three kids. One was an angel, one was a prick, one was a real fucking idiot. You know, and that's just life. And all of a sudden I'm like, okay, I can deal with this a little bit better. But to deal with it on your own, you drive yourself around the twist. Right? You know, you remember the old adage, right? We all drunk alone. But we don't have to stop drinking alone, all right? So developing that courage, do it on Strive. Strive is a place you need to be. I just asked for feedback on all my Strivers. Why did you come here? What was it about it that made you, that draw you in? One of the number one things that people said about, I realized I couldn't do this alone. I was fed up of trying to do it alone. I realized that I needed support. So there you are, Obi-Wan Kenobi. I hope you got some benefit out of that. I'm just going to unmute the ladies. Do you have any questions on that while I take a deep breath after I've wobbled on for 40 minutes?
I did a meeting last night with Nikki, Kim, and Anna. And Kim was, she's very bright and determined. And you can just see it in her. And I had no idea she'd already stopped for 18 months before.
Mm.
So she's been round and round and round with this beast for a long time.
Yeah, and she's saying that what she's experiencing now, she's never experienced before. So even in those 18 months, she's never, something different is happening with her.
Just like with them, when I went to AA and moderation management and the whole thing for 10 years, it never clicked like it did when I got your message.
Mm-hmm.
It always felt like, and I told Kim this last night, it always felt like it was something I had to give up. And my sponsor in AA even told me that I had lost the privilege to drink. Well, what makes you want to drink if you're a rebellious person?
Yeah.
That didn't work for me. Sorry. You know, I need to have it as something that I got rid of. My choice.
Yeah, definitely.
It really worked with Kim, you know, she was like, exactly.
And that was on the, so we have a Strive Australasia meeting now because we can't get everybody on the same meetings because we're global.
But I can get both of them.
Yeah. Good. It's good to have you here, Holly. It's good to have you here.
Yeah, 5 o'clock in the evening for me, but it was the next day in New Zealand, of course.
Mm.
And then this morning it's 9 a.m., so.
And it's good to have you here. Scott, how long is it? How long have you been someone who doesn't drink alcohol now?
Almost, let's see, it's been a year and 3 months.
And how do you feel?
Victorious. I still got my sword. I'm still in the ring, you know, the gladiator.
What about you, Stella? What's going through your, any questions on anything I've just waffled about?
Points
you want to emphasize?
Points sometimes, like triggers, for instance, when people get triggers. A lot of the time, you're just thirsty, hungry, tired, and what else did I think? That how I am in myself, that's what I feel it is. So first of all, I take a drink, I eat something, and just three breaths. And then I've sort of like had my three hits. I've leaned it. I've learned it. and then I love it. So I just think, oh, I'm there. Well, I'm fine now. And it passes. I don't know if anyone's been to Greymouth. When we went to New Zealand and then we went to the thing, and I posted on here about that awful incident. Anyway, we left to get on the train and we were in Greymouth. And I still was feeling quite really odd. And I couldn't put my finger on it. And I kept talking myself out of things. A little bit like what Kim was doing with the pub.
Mm.
But I was talking myself out of things. Oh, I don't need to journal. I can't be bothered to write. I'll just be scruffy. It'll just be scruffy. I don't want to talk to Lizzie and Brian. I don't want to sit in the room. I'll just sit in here. I'll just have a look at my iPad. There's a swimming pool over there. Shall I go swimming tomorrow? Nah, I don't need to go swimming. Why don't you just go for a walk? No, I don't want to go for a walk. What would you want to do then? Well, I don't know. So there were loads of stuff going through my mind anyway. I just pulled myself back, did that breathing again. Because you forget to breathe, you kind of like you don't hold your breath, obviously, so you're going to die. But you just don't, you just kind of like shallow breathing instead of, you know, like that.
Mm.
Big, deep breath. I just sat with myself for a minute, and then that's when I realized, start journaling, because there's something going on and you're not, and it's all like all the chat is going on in your head, and it looks like the telly when it's finished, when it used to finish with the fizz. And I couldn't put it all straight and put it into place. So I started journaling. One of them was, I felt like I'd abandoned the people when I left on the train. I hadn't had enough exercise and I hadn't drank enough water in the day to compensate for my over-processing brain.
Mm.
And that's when I realized that even when you're overthinking things, well, me personally, I actually need to make sure that I've got enough water, that I've drank enough, and that I've took enough food in. So yeah, that helped loads. Because you see, I thought, oh, I'm fine, you know, I'll be okay. And then that massive thing happened and I thought, actually, no, I'm not okay. I mean, even talking about it now, I can feel it being funny in there, and going back to thinking, where do I go that's safe? What happens if this happens? What happens if that comes back? What if this does this, this and this?
Hmm.
And I had to process it all in my mind, and I was thinking, would you drink right now? If you could have access, what would you drink? And I thought, well, maybe I would, you know, maybe why don't you just take some caffeine? So I sat and drank all the coffee that was in the room, because there was nothing else in there that I normally have. I didn't take no nettle tea. I didn't take anything that I normally drink. So yeah, actually, that's the first time I've ever been close to feeling something like how Kim felt in a long time.
Mm.
And it sort of shocked me. And then I thought to myself, when I was safe and I was in Greymouth and I was sitting on my bed, am I only thinking these things now because I'm safe, and I felt unsafe when I was, you know, in Christchurch? Is it because I felt unsafe there and now I'm thinking all this stuff and I'm being able to think more clearly, when I thought I was thinking clearly there? So yeah, that's the first time I've ever come across that. It were a bit, yeah. So I get everything you said just now, and I've been jotting it down. And for me, that willpower at the beginning turned into like a feeling of adrenaline. So now I liken willpower to adrenaline. You can only run your adrenaline for so long, because adrenaline can't keep running. It has, you know, all of a sudden, you'd just faint, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
So if that episode, and I didn't want it to happen, but it did, if it hadn't done, I wouldn't have been able to kind of like piece together like the end bit, you know, like that film when you say, like in the intensives, we make a film of our lives and stuff. That's a whole chunk that would have been missing out of mine. And now the chunk's not missing now.
Mm.
I've filled my film in with that big chunk that was going on from my younger life, and then I've got my middle life, and then I feel like I'm having like an end life, if you see what I mean.
Well,
does that make sense?
Well, you're more a word that I hear a lot throughout Strive is clarity. So once you're not drinking alcohol, you develop a greater sense of clarity. And what you're doing at the moment, it sounds like, is you're piecing back together a life, or trying to analyze, well, if I want to be the better version of who I want to be, then what does that look like? What does my environment look like? What do my values look like? You know, how do I think? And it just sounds like because you've got this clarity and you're thinking about these things, that these life lessons suddenly they're there right in front of you. In this case, like through a really traumatic event, you know, like if people are listening to this and are not aware, Stella was very close to the incident where 43 people were shot and killed in New Zealand in Christchurch. So that's what she's talking about. And yet without this clarity, these pieces of this puzzle, and it sounds like you've just found the last piece, they'd still be scattered all around the place. We wouldn't even be looking for them. And that to me is the real tragedy about alcohol, and why I believe that alcoholism. Okay, let me, how do I put this? So we know on the intensity we talk about the alcohol spectrum. And we say that, you know, we say there is no alcoholic. We're all on that spectrum. And the spectrum kind of leans down a little bit, like, you know, the pitcher plant with Alan Carr's, you know, in Alan Carr's book. And towards the bottom here of this spectrum is the person who is really screwed up. Like, they're quite evidently, you look at them and you will very quickly put them into your archetype of what an alcoholic is being ingrained into our mind, right? So they're disheveled, they're fucked up, they look really bad, they're homeless, like they piss their pants, they got a bottle in a brown paper bag, right? Then, lost my train of thought. Give me a minute. Ah, okay. And then at the other end of that, or somewhere else on that spectrum, you've got my dad, right? And my dad has been drinking every weekend, okay, and a couple of times in a week for, what is he now? He's like six, nearly 70, so like 50 years or whatever, right? And if that's my dad, or anyone around my dad, if he's an alcoholic and he had a show of hands, not one person's going to put their hands up, right? But the guy who's at the bottom end, like the fucked up end, we know that he's got a real issue, so people can help him. Like he's wearing a big banner saying I need help just by who he is. But my dad is hidden. What alcohol has done to him is hidden him, right? And for me, that's where the real tragedy lies, is that when he dies, he will have died a life that has not been as fulfilling as it could have been. Now, I know a lot of you could probably say, well, that's a real subjective thing to say. How do you know your dad's not lived the more fulfilling life? He could turn around and say, well, I was really fulfilled in my life. I know my dad. He's my dad. There's no way on earth that man has led a fulfilled life. He has been held back. And the tragedy is he doesn't even know he's holding himself back. He doesn't even know that he's making choices that are nullifying his experience, that are making him ill, that in the next 10 to 20 years are going to be really defining moments for my parents, because this is where the years and years and years of drinking and smoking are going to come back and bite him in the ass. Because, you know, there is very few glorious deaths with people, you know, when it comes to these type of things. That's the tragedy. That is why we do the work that we do, you know. I think that's like really super important. I don't know why I went on to that. What did I go on to that for?
I think Stella was able to get closure to the incident when usually you would just drink because it was so painful. Mm. It would all be still there, and it could always bubble up later and bite you and make you want to drink again and again, or just give you PTSD or what have you. But since she had the clarity, she was able to put it all together, not bury it, but deal with it right on the spot. You know, right when those bad feelings were coming up, you had guilt, you felt like, you know, you had left those people behind or whatever. When usually, if you're drinking, you just have a drink and it's done and you think, okay, that's over, but it's really not.
Yeah, good point. It's almost like in the intensive, we do that. We do this section on risk assessment, don't we? So we say to ourselves, all right, we're all in our 40s, 50s, 60s or whatever. We're smart people. We've experienced enough of drinking. We can foresee what's going to trip us up. Let's make a list of all the things that are going to trip us up. And then let's put some plans in place to eradicate them or to mitigate them. However, we're never going to write on that list, I'm in Christchurch and an idiot comes in and kills 43 people. I was never going to write on my list, my wife is going to ask me for a divorce. People are not going to write on the list. I mean, they do write on the list, don't they? What would happen if I lost a loved one, et cetera, et cetera. But you don't know what's going to happen in that moment. I know this though, when I got divorced, it ripped the heart out of me and I drank for a month after it. So 3 years of not drinking and I drank. And I could tell you this, had I drunk, if I got divorced today, okay, and I drank as a result of it on day one, by the end of day one, or maybe on the morning of day two, I would be on Strive. Mm-hmm. And there's no way I'd make day three of drinking. Yeah. Because the support system and the vow and the role that I have and the accountability, there's no way, no way that I would have gone. Yeah, look, it took me a month of drinking for my little boy to say to me when I ordered a bottle of wine, Dad, I thought you said there was no value in alcohol. That was a 10-year-old boy. Imagine if one of you two would have said to me, hey, Lee, hey, come on. You've been saying there's no value in alcohol. What's going on here? What's happened? You know, you get on the intensive and work through this because you've just somebody's just bit you on the ass, right? And then I would have been back in the game. So the support system here is like really, really super important, you know? Really super important.
The whole Strive experience just ruins drinking for you anyways.
yeah. Definitely. So we're coming up to the hour. I just wanted to say, I'm not sure what I'm going to do with this, but on the, on the wall there, just in the other room, there is a little child's poster and it's on calming strategies. So when Zia goes on full meltdown now, and what we're doing is we're picking her up and we're taking her to the poster and we're saying, which emotion are you feeling right now? And there's happiness, sadness, joy and anger, I think. And invariably she'll say angry or sad, right? And then I've been asking her why she's angry or sad, but a lot of times she says, I don't know, okay? And through Liza's guidance, I've stopped asking her that now, okay? What I then do next to it is there are 11 coping strategies, okay? So then I say to her, do you want to choose a coping strategy where we can move you from, like, sometimes I'll say, so she'll say she's sad. I say, do you want to be happy? Now, sometimes she'll say no. She'll say, no, I want to be sad, right? No, I'll say, okay, you can be sad. But if she says, no, I want to be happy, I'll say, well, do you want to pick one of your coping mechanisms? Now, I'll read them out because it links back to what Stella was saying. Number one is close your eyes. Two is take a drink, which is what Stella just said. Three, stretch your body. Four, hug a stuffed animal. Five, take three deep breaths, which is what Stella just said. Six, draw. Seven, read a book. Eight, think a happy thought. Nine, do a puzzle. 10, count to 10. And 11, squeeze a ball. Now these are for a kid. All right. Now I'm going to be writing a poker article about these actually in a short while, but I'm also going to be incorporating this into the intensive because it's about tacit knowledge and explicit knowledge, which is something that I've just stumbled across in the Happiness Hypothesis by Jonathan Haidt. So explicit knowledge, alcohol is going to fuck us up. That's explicit. We know it's going to happen, right? But knowing it doesn't really, that's not going to cut it. The tacit knowledge is checking in on Strive every day, posting in help and guidance every day, taking the taster, taking the intensive, filling in triggers and using these 11 coping strategies every time we're angry or we're sad or we're happy. Because let's be honest, we drink alcohol when we don't want to, when we're happy as well, right? So using these coping mechanisms like are super important, but we're only able to use them like automatically after we develop more tacit knowledge. And that's what we do when we're on the internet. And this is why like a big mistake that people make is they'll take the taster and then they won't take the intensive, because they'll take the taster and they'll think, oh, fucking nailed it. I've done it. Boom, boom, boom. But you're just brushing up on your explicit knowledge. You haven't got the tacit experience yet. That's going to take many, many years of work. Okay. And it's terrifying and almost off-putting to think that you have to work on these things for many years, but it's just fact. If you want to be a better version of yourself, then you're going to be working at it until the day that you're pushing up daisies, and not to think that it's hard work. It's like, it's wonderful. You know, it's absolutely, surfing. What's surfing like? How does it feel to surf?
Well, you know, some days you can be scared to death and you just got to do it, or you just don't do it. And then you beat yourself up later because you were such a wimp. But then when you actually do it and you feel like you're flying, you know, it's all worth it.
Yeah. You know, it's like, it's growth. It's like, you know,
I put alcohol in the same category as dieting, because I have to be, I'm one of those people that can't just eat whatever I want, you know? Mm. So you have to learn in the beginning that this is how your life's going to be. You're never going to be somebody that can just go get a dozen donuts, you know, and you eventually make peace with that and embrace it. But it's really hard in the beginning. I mean, I've lost 40 pounds 3 times, you know? So I always say to myself, this is just, it's going to be a lifelong thing. There's no quick fix. There's no pill you can take. And you're going to have to read a lot of books and get a lot of knowledge.
Yeah. This is our life. This is our life. It's not like a fad. It's our life, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, and between, how long have you been someone who doesn't drink alcohol, Stella?
I stopped drinking October
2017. 2, 3. All right. So between the three of us, we've got like nearly 15 years of experience of not drinking. Okay.
Wow.
Like I, what do I do for a living? I write poker articles. What do you do for a living, Holly?
I dog sit.
You dog sit. What do you do for a living, Stella?
That's wonderful, isn't it? I do hairdressing.
You're a hairdresser, right? We're just normal people.
Yeah.
Right? We're not, we haven't got degrees in neuroscience, but we've got degrees in life, you know?
Yes, exactly.
And that's the key to me. You know, again, the feedback that I got the other day when I was asking why people are here. You know, they just said, you just seemed real, Lee. Well, everybody seems real here. You know, we've all gone through it. We've all experienced the tumultuous ride of and the dips and the ups and downs. And, you know, that for me is everything. You know, Strive is everything. So if you're not a member of Strive, then get over to www.thetruthaboutalcohol.co.uk and join today. It is £5 a month. Yeah, somebody wrote to me the other day and said, I can't believe you charge people to do this. What would you do if someone was suffering from suicide? Well, to that person, there's a reason why we charge people. You know, we like the intimacy that we have at Strive. We do want to grow it, but we do want to branch out. But the intimacy for us is really important. And putting a bit of money in there actually helps to really just get the people who are really serious about taking some action on board. It enables me to, there's accountability there because you put your hand in your pocket. It enables me to focus on this full time. It enables me to provide world-class quality training for the ambassadors and to create better and better experiences for you. Even simple things, folks, like getting certain people on a podcast will cost money. Like improving the sound quality of a podcast will cost money. I mean, you know, let's not be silly about this. Like if you want something for free, then AA is there for you. Okay. You can listen to every single one of our podcasts. I know a guy who through just listening to my podcast absolutely and utterly transformed his life. Went from like, I don't know, big fat guy to a thin, muscular guy running marathons and that. And he never joined Strive. He never listened to the taster. He never did a taste, never did intensive, never put his hand in his pocket. He just listened to the podcast, right? So, you know, when we think there's nothing here for free, this is here for free, right? So I get where you're coming from. I felt exactly the same when I was back in the day trying to join Jack Canfield's Success Principles program. It was £3,000 and I was 30 grand in debt. But, you know, within a year, I wasn't in debt. So each their own. So yeah, it's £5. If you can't afford £5, then write me an email at truthaboutalcohol@gmail.com. We'll sort something out because we don't want money to be a barrier. Yeah, there are price tags on everything. But as far as I was aware, last time I looked, the vast majority of people who've taken the intensive haven't even paid for it. So think about that. Right. Holly, aloha.
Aloha.
Stella, see you later. And everybody listening, keep it sweet. I'll take care. Bye-bye, everyone. If the truth about alcohol philosophy jives with you and you want to become someone that doesn't drink alcohol, then there are several options available to you, okay? According to the research carried out by Janice and James Prochaska, there are 6 stages of change when it comes to defeating an addiction. And let me assure you, that is your problem. It is an addiction, right? Now, these 6 stages of change are as follows. 1, pre-contemplation. 2, contemplation. 3, preparation. 4, action. 5, maintenance. And 6, termination. And translated into truth about alcohol philosophy, these categories become this, right? 1, the death effect. 2, visualization. 3, incubation. 4, ready, steady, go. 5, transformation. And 6, service. And that just makes a nice little acronym, STRIVE. Ha! That's why I did that, right? So these 6 stages of the truth about alcohol are not fixed in stone, right? They're fluid, and you'll move between these stages depending on a variety of different factors. But understanding where you are on this spectrum is really critical, okay? Now, 1, the first category you're going to be in, which the Prochaska's called pre-contemplation, and I'm calling the death effect, that's when you really are struck by the zombification of societal condition. You have no idea that alcohol is a problem, that alcoholism exists. You just think that alcohol is fucking brilliant, and that is the end of, right? And that will not be affecting you right now because you're here listening to this. But that is that first level, that first category, the death effect. At the second level, contemplation, as the Prochaska's call it, or for me, visualization, this is where you start to think and question the role that alcohol has in your life, right? And as you're thinking about this and you're pondering and you're kind of visualizing kind of like, you know, how alcohol is having a negative effect in your life and what it could possibly be like if it's not in your life anymore, you may have joined the Alcohol Addiction Podcast and listened to this. You may have headed over to the truthaboutalcohol.co.uk and joined our email list. You might be reading our blog post. You might have picked up a few books and started reading on those. At the third stage is called preparation, right? Or what we call incubation. And this is where you might go a little bit further. And you're now starting not only to kind of listen to podcasts and read some books, but you're actually preparing to change, right? The idea that you could potentially be someone that doesn't drink alcohol is starting to incubate. And you could, at this stage, have joined a community forum like Strive, or you might have joined NIST Naked Minds forum or Hip Sobriety's Facebook group or something. But you're starting to prepare for change. The fourth category is action, or what we call ready, steady, go. And this is where you really are now starting to take some real solid action. And if you're ready to take action, then you should take the Truth About Alcohol Taster. And the Truth About Alcohol Taster is a 27-day program. You can join the program whenever you like. You just go to thetruthaboutalcohol.co.uk and you can find the links there to join up, or you can email me at thetruthaboutalcohol@gmail.com and I'll sort you out. You join basically a group and you can just work on being someone who doesn't drink alcohol for 27 days to give it a little bit of a feel. We'll introduce you to the Truth About Alcohol philosophy, our 3 modules of truth, awareness, and freedom. We'll learn to help you see the truth about alcohol, why you drink, why it's so difficult to stop, raise awareness of that truth internally so you can start to change some of those neurological pathways, those thought process and belief systems around alcohol. And then freedom, how do you assert yourself back into a society of people that don't drink alcohol? You do the homework on Strive, you get an assignment moment every day for myself, and one of the true alcohol ambassadors will lead you along the way. So that's kind of the action stage. The fifth stage is called maintenance, or what we call transformation. This is where the work really takes off, right? Now, it's really important to understand that moving between the incubation phase and the ready, steady, go phase, you know, so whilst you're kind of like preparing to take action, that could take anywhere up to 6 months. And when once you've started to take action, the actual maintenance phase, which is what we call transformation, the stage where you are really working on becoming someone that doesn't drink alcohol permanently, that phase can take up to 5 years, right? It can take that long. It certainly takes six months plus for you to really nail it or give yourself a good shot at this. And for that reason, we've created the intensive. The Trooper Alcohol Intensive, it's a year, an annual subscription where we get really deep into the truth about alcohol, raising awareness of that truth and working out how to be free of it. And we're up to like 70 plus coaching videos. You work with all the Truth About Alcohol ambassadors and myself. It's a great, great process, okay? One of the big mistakes people make is they'll take the taster, so they start to take action, and then once they finish the taster, they don't continue into the maintenance phase, and that can lead them fall back into some of those earlier categories. So it's really important to do the intensive and get through that transformation phase. And then finally, sixth, termination, as the Prochaskas call it, or I like to call it service. This is where it doesn't matter what happens now, you're never going to drink alcohol. It doesn't matter, you're never triggered, nothing ever happens, you're just fucking done with it, right? And that's where I am right now. And this is where we at the Truth About Alcohol can offer you some roles to, you know, give back to the community, give back to the world, and help me create this movement of a million people that don't drink alcohol. And that is to extend yourself into the roles of either a Strive ambassador, where you lead in the Strive movement and really are a rock helping new people come to Strive, or you can become a Truth About Alcohol ambassador, where we pay you to take control of the taster groups and the intensive groups and really work with people who are ready to take the action phase. So if you are ready right now, okay, to start to think about moving up into the next stage, so, you know, you're in contemplation phase now and you're thinking about going to preparation, join Strive, right? It's £5 a month. It'll be the best £5 you've ever spent. If you're ready to take action, if you're ready to do something about this, then join the taster. Okay, that's £99, right? Join the taster. And then if you are just ready to just fucking be someone that doesn't drink alcohol and that is like something you want to do permanently, then join the intensive. That is £1,000. We've got payment plans available. Do not let money be the reason why you do not take this, because we can always sort something out or find you some help, all right? So head over to thetruthaboutalcohol.co.uk to join those experiences, or give me an email at truthaboutalcohol@gmail.com. Remember this, folks, okay? You drink alone, but you do not have to stop drinking alone. That's why we're here for you. So reach out and help. Take care of yourself.